Welcome to episode 436 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Rachel Maney. Rachel is the National Director of Bike Law, which is a network of independent bike crash lawyers. And two of the main things that you will be able to take from this interview is, firstly, how to minimize the risk of being involved in a crash through safety precautions and understanding how most crashes happen. And secondly, what you should do if you or somebody you know is involved in a crash. And when we're talking about crashes here, we are talking about crashes with motorists, so in particular, car drivers. But before we get into the interview with Rachel, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. And one of the things that I love about them is that they make it very easy to hit your numbers. So for example, before I found Precision Fuel and Hydration, I used products that might have gels that were 22 grams of carbs and sodium products that had all sorts of amounts of sodium, but typically very small. So you had to pop a lot of them at the same time to reach reasonable levels of sodium. And this was a challenge, especially in long races, to keep track of everything. With Precision Fuel and Hydration products, it's very simple. Their gels contain 30 grams or 90 grams of carbs, or 300 grams in the case of the Flow Gel. It's easier to carry, to keep track of, and it's a multiple of the standard recommendations for carb consumption per hour. So you have the 60 to 90 gram recommendations. And the same goes for the sodium products. It's super simple, and this might sound like a small thing, but when you're in a race and your brain is not really at its full cognitive capacity, I think it makes a pretty big difference in being able to stick to your plan. So I love this aspect of the Precision Fuel and Hydration products, and it's something that is maybe not talked about so much, but this is something that is important in sports nutrition products, I think. As a listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. For a lot of athletes, the limitation to swim training is that it can be very time-consuming to swim when you consider everything that goes into a swim, with commuting to the pool, all of the faff that you may have to get through at the pool before actually getting into the water, and so on and so forth. This means that for a lot of people, it might only be realistic to swim once or twice per week, but with the Senate, you can complement that pool swimming, or for that matter, open water swimming, with some quick and efficient home-based workouts that challenge the swim-specific muscles, so you can increase that all-important frequency of training and give yourself a chance to keep improving your swimming even when your pool time is limited. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Rachel Maney. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Rachel. How are you doing?
I am well. Thank you so much for asking and for having me.
It's great to have you. Can you start by introducing yourself to the audience?
Yes. My name is Rachel Maney, and I am the resident long course triathlete at Bike Law. I'm also the national director of Bike Law and the co-founder of our advocacy arm, which is our nonprofit organization, the Bike Law Foundation. Bike Law was founded by my partner, attorney Peter Wilborn, in 1998. The genesis of Bike Law was the untimely death of his little brother. He was killed in a cycling crash by an underage driver who blew through a red light and struck another vehicle, propelled that vehicle into the air, pinning Jim between it and a truck, and he died at the scene of the crash. He was 28 years old at the time that occurred. Peter, as the lawyer in the family, was tasked with hiring or interviewing different lawyers to determine who would be best to represent his family. And the attorney that he spoke with, who was most highly recommended, asked Peter if Jim had a DUI. And Peter, of course, was taken aback and asked, "Why would you ask that?" The attorney said, "Well, why else would a grown man be on a bike?" And that was the catalyst for taking a very specific skill set that Peter had developed as a civil rights attorney and recognizing that he could use that skill set to represent and to protect another marginalized group of people, which are people on bikes.
Yeah, I mean, that is a tragic founding story, of course, and a tragic part of that is that question about whether you would only be on a bike if you have a DUI. Can you talk a bit more about, since that genesis of Bike Law, what has it grown to be today, and what exactly are you doing, and where do you operate?
Sure. So I think that over the last quarter of a century, bike law has evolved into a comprehensive cycling resource. There's, I think, two silos in which bike law exists. And the first is the legal representation of bicyclists who have been involved in a collision or a crash. They've suffered the indignities of those types of incidents, or the families or next of kin or cyclists who are killed in crashes, or anybody on a bike who has an issue, a challenge, or a problem that would be better worked out with legal representation. So that lives over here. The second part of what bike law does is underneath of the advocacy umbrella, the lawyers in the Bike Law Network who are independently practicing bicycle crash attorneys, they work collaboratively with other boots on the ground organizations and advocates to protect their local communities and provide resources and ways to affect positive change for people on bikes in their particular jurisdiction. Bike law is, I think, an ethos at this point. We are a mission-driven organization that is led largely by the attorneys in our network. All of them are cyclists first. They are our lawyers second. So they understand the cultural, the physical, financial, the mental aspects of being in the saddle. They can tell you the difference between a fork and a derailleur. That's pretty important. But they can take their understanding, analysis, and application of the law and use that to best serve their clients in ways that I think are very, very unique. So we're involved in all aspects of better biking or trying to promote or achieve a standard of better biking, which is, you know, equitable access, representation, safety, and the celebration of what we firmly believe is probably the single greatest way to save the world. So,
can you talk a bit more about that, the better biking aspect, and how you try to advocate for those different things, including better equality, better access, and so on?
Sure. So, you know, it's going to vary from place to place and certainly from country to country around the world. But when we think about cyclists, I think that there are underserved and underrepresented groups of people on bikes within our cycling community. Oftentimes, and especially as somebody who participates or who competes in a multi-sport, you know, event, or who considers themselves a competitive cyclist or triathlete, most of the time we're going to be riding with other like-minded cyclists, people who are training for a purpose, who are, you know, looking to compete in a particular event. There's also tens of millions of cyclists just in North America who live at or below the poverty line, people who are relegated to using the bike for its original intended purpose to get from point A to point B. We don't have the most accurate statistics for how many of those people are in need of our services because their suffering and the crashes in which they are involved are largely underreported. That being said, when we talk about what bike law does to promote or pursue cycling justice and better biking, we're looking to meet the needs of all of those different types of bikers, not just the ones that we're riding with on a group ride on Saturday or who we're seeing, you know, in T1 as we fly out and head out for the bike portion of a triathlon. So the needs of our cycling community are as diverse as its members. And so I think the goal or the objective is to make sure that we are looking at those needs equally and doing the best that we can to address those needs, regardless of which specific demographic within our community those needs belong to.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And you mentioned safety as well. So maybe that's a good place to start, because we'll obviously get into what to do if you are involved in a crash, but ideally you don't want to do that. So there are some things that you can do to minimize the risk. Can you talk a bit more about safety strategies?
Sure. I think that the advice that we would have given, let's say just 20 years ago, is it's almost moot. So there have always been hot topics or buzzwords in bike advocacy over time, you know, whether it's taking the lane or high vis or as far right as practicable, right? These types of things, while not unimportant, I think that generally what we're confronted with is the uptick in traffic violence because of the usage of handheld devices, cell phones, smartphones, driver impatience, and anti-bike bias. So 25 years ago, we could have given actual instructions or advice to somebody on a bike to say, make sure that you're visible, make sure that you are riding in a place that is safer than other places maybe. But ultimately, I think today there is no way to protect yourself against distracted drivers or aggressive drivers or people who just simply aren't paying attention to what's in front of them. You could be dressed like a disco ball wrapped in Christmas lights. And if somebody isn't looking at the roadway, they are not going to see you. So, you know, all of that being said, one of the most important things, because the rules and the regulations are different from place to place, it's that you want to ride predictably. Because we can't anticipate what somebody behind the wheel is going to do, we want to put ourselves in a position where those drivers can anticipate what we are going to do. It may be wildly unpopular, but I think the moral of the story is just because you can doesn't necessarily mean that you should. And thinking about all of those different variables and factors, like what is the maintenance of the roadway? And this is obviously, I want to make sure that everybody understands this is if you have a choice. A lot of people don't. But for those of us who do, choosing places where visibility isn't obstructed, choosing places where the roads or the bike lanes are well maintained, where you're not going to be forced to ride on rumble strips and no shoulder, places where there is greater representation. So obviously, people who are used to seeing people on bikes, they drive in such a way where they're cognizant of the vulnerable road users with whom they're sharing the roadway. A lot of times what we see, especially in the elite triathlete and cycling community, is people will actually travel to places where there is less car traffic, wide open country roads, and there is an increased prevalence of crashes there because motorists there are unfamiliar with people on bikes. I'm not saying don't go to those places to ride. It's just, it's a very nuanced question with a very nuanced answer.
Yeah, I mean, on that point, I think that the places where I've ridden that, where all the drivers seem to be paying attention at all times and be very respectful, are the places where there are the absolute largest number of cyclists, like Mallorca, the Canaries, and so on, of the places that I've visited. The Dolomites in Italy as well come to mind.
Sure. I mean, we think about, it's really tough because everybody in the US or in North America will generally compare American cycling or cycling in other places to Amsterdam, Copenhagen, you know, Girona. And that's all fine and great. But there is a cultural aspect that we're not taking into consideration. When we're talking about bike safety, the prevalence of traffic violence, crash statistics, those numbers are always going to be inversely proportional to rideshare and ridership, meaning how many people are on bikes and how many trips are being taken by bike. The higher those numbers, the lower the crash statistics. The lower those numbers, the more people you're going to find being injured and killed while riding a bike.
Yeah. Well, that is proportionally though, I assume.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You mentioned, even though you said that it's almost moot at in this day and age, but you mentioned the term taking the lane. Can you, I'm not sure every listener has heard that term. Can you explain that and what it means? Because you also mentioned as far right as possible. So they kind of are opposite to each other.
Right. So, and this is, again, critical thinking, common sense, discretion, some of the most important tools that any person can have in their toolbox, regardless of what the subject matter is being discussed. But there are times when taking the lane is absolutely safer. For example, and that's the same as riding two abreast. And that's something that you and I had talked about prior to this particular recording. But just as a general concept in cycling, there are always going to be situations in which that might not be the best idea. There are going to be rules and laws in places that may preclude a bicyclist from riding two abreast or from riding in a certain place versus another. generally taking the lane gives is supposed to make you more visible, right? Riding two abreast is supposed to help you mimic the size of a motor vehicle in that traffic lane. So for example, if I'm riding in the mountains and there's switchbacks and changes of elevation, I'm going to be much better off riding two abreast, right? So that there is clear visibility for the people behind me than I'm going to be hugging that white fog line when a motorist might not be able to see me. If there is infrastructure that exists that is usable, me personally, I use it, right? I'm not going to ride down the middle of a traffic lane during rush hour traffic if there is a beautiful paved shoulder or a bike lane. You know, obviously things like debris or cars that are parallel parked that could put a bicyclist in danger of a dooring crash or something like that. Those have to be considered. But if we're just talking generally, you've got motor vehicles and then to the right or to the left, there is a carved out space for people to walk or ride their bikes, then my personal choice and recommendation would be to utilize that infrastructure. If you need to make yourself more visible, if you are going to be making a left-hand turn, for example, as an American cyclist, don't attempt to make that left-hand turn from, you know, the furthermost or furthest most portion of the right-hand shoulder, right? You want to start to progressively make yourself more visible, signal whatever you need to do, so that the people behind you, again, can predict and anticipate what it is you're going to do. It's all about making sure that they see you.
What would you do in a situation when there is no shoulder? The lane is just wide enough to allow for you to ride at the very right-hand side of the lane, and the car can still pass you in the lane, but it's a kind of a tight pass. Would you take the lane to make yourself more visible, or would you still try to stay right?
Yes, I probably would take the lane. And again, it's a general question, and there's always going to be some variable where someone's going to say, well, what about this? Well, then you have to factor that into your decision. So just to be clear, just generally speaking, yes, if the lane is just wide enough for a vehicle to squeeze past me, if there is no shoulder, if there's rumble strips, if I am going to be safer and more visible, and I'm going to force the people behind me to be patient while I'm riding, then that's what I'm going to do for sure.
Yeah. Well, one thing that a lot of athletes, cyclists, triathletes use these days is something like a Garmin Varia, a radar. What about those sorts of tools? Do you think that they are helpful?
Of course. And let me think about this. These types of technological or equipment-based tools or protective safety measures, they're passive. Right, they are things that undoubtedly we are better off for having and using than we would be without them, but they're not the end all be all, nor are they going to prevent something horrible from occurring. A lot of our clients were involved in crashes where there's a left or a right hook collision, meaning a motorist is making a left turn or a right turn and striking a cyclist who is going traveling straight. But we have an equal, if not greater, number of clients who were struck directly from behind. I'd say of those clients, half of those clients were using a Garmin Varia or something that gives audible and visual notification to both the cyclist and the motorist behind them that there's somebody on a bike that they are approaching. The problem is, by the time you get that notification, obviously, operating a bicycle is very, very different. The physics, just the science, is different than driving a car. And so even a person with the best bike handling skills and reaction time really doesn't have a way out if the person behind them isn't paying attention and is traveling 60, 70 miles an hour, right? That thing can beep and flash as much as it wants, and it's not going to prevent a crash. That being said, absolutely use it. The rear red blinking light is probably the most significant and important invention for a bicyclist since the wheel.
Yeah. And I guess like this is not something that is based on statistics, but maybe you may know, but this is an area where I have thought that it makes sense to go for something that is really good and with like a really bright light, and that costs a bit more money, but it's just worth it. Because I think, I don't know what it's like in the US, but in many countries in Europe, it is mandatory for cyclists to have a rear blinking red light. But then you can easily get a light for 10 euros in the mega store or something, and it's, but it's not very bright, and it's not very easy for the motorists to see. And but then compared to something that is kind of more high end but really is very visible, it does seem to me that it makes a big difference to have a much higher quality rear light, although it's also not a prevention for a completely distracted driver, of course.
Yeah, could not agree with you more. And here, like especially in the US, each you say countries, and it's so attractive to me, the idea of there being national legislation or regulations on what people have to do. And you can go to a country, France is a great example. You know, whether people agree or not, there is compliance. You come to a place like the US, states have the authority to enact and enforce their own rules and regulations. You might be surprised, but there are very few nationally consistent laws that govern traffic. If you are not interstate truck driver, or you're not carrying hazardous material from one state to the next, it's very uncommon to find consistency from one place to the next. In addition to that, so Peter and I moved Bike Law's headquarters to Florida 5 years ago following the bike crash epidemic and the crash fatality statistics. In doing so, riding in Miami, which is in the southern part of the state, is completely different than riding in the Panhandle or in Central Florida. So even in one state, in one country, the differences can be greater than the similarities. That being said, what you're talking about as far as the strength of the lights or the equipment that people can purchase, each state will have a different rule or law about what is required as far as safety equipment for your bicycle. Generally, in most places, a red rear light or reflector is required. And in some places, the law goes on even further to specifically require a certain number of lumens. And those lumens, the higher the lumens, the brighter the light. So roundabout answer or response to what you said, but we agree completely.
Yeah. What's your take on front lights?
So, interesting question. Obviously, if it's dark, you should have a front lamp. What we see a lot are people who want to put those front white lamps or lights in strobe mode at all times.
Sorry, one moment. My headphones are doing something. So just hold on. Okay, can you say something now?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you. I'm sorry.
You're totally fine.
Shut up. Can you maybe restart with just the answer to the from the beginning, the answer to the front light question?
Sure. So the front light question is, again, like most of these, going to be a little bit more nuanced. Yes, a front white light. Yes, it should have different modes. But what we see oftentimes are people who want to set that front white lamp or light into strobe mode. There is nothing more distracting than that blinking light. If you're in a group ride, do not use that strobe function. It's very distracting to everybody. There are statistics that have been collected and compiled over many, many, many years of research that actually show that sometimes those fast flashing front strobe type lights, as opposed to a steady white lamp, can actually be attractive to drunk drivers. And you actually find that intoxicated motorists will steer directly into a bicyclist because they're fixated on that white flashing light.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is fascinating. I did not know that. And it maybe it explains actually an incident that I had once riding here in Lisbon, or outside of Lisbon, where I had the flashing mode on my front light on, and I was stopped by the police, and they said that the front light cannot be flashing. So, and that I didn't know that part of the legislation about cycling here, but this, the front light has by law to be steady, and maybe that statistic has something to do with it.
It probably does, because if you think about nothing is going to, and that's why the red rear blinking light is so important, because we ride in the same direction as traffic. And so what's most, I think, destabilizing is not knowing what's coming behind you, right? As a runner, as a triathlete, when you go out for your run, if you're running in the roadway, you're running against traffic. You want to see what's approaching. Cycling is completely different. And in most places, generally, it is unlawful to ride against traffic. So you always want to be going with the flow of motor traffic. That being said, the flashing rear red light is what gets that motorist's attention to say, there is someone there. I need to be cautious. I need to exercise a heightened duty of care to that person. When you're talking about what you're projecting in front of you, if oncoming traffic is attracted to that blinking light or distracted by that blinking light, there is a chance. And what the statistical increase or that chance is, I do not know. But we have enough data and information to say that in many, many places, there can be an increase in drunk driver crashes when somebody has that blinking white light. So that steady white lamp, 100% all the time, especially when it's dusk or when it's dark. But if you can keep it off of that strobe function and just leave the flashing to the rear red light, that would be our advice.
Mm. And so you said that the majority of crashes are either left or they distribute as left and right and turns, and then also crashes from right from behind. Did you say that they were equal more or less in terms of distribution, or can you talk a bit more about the distribution of those types of crashes?
So I think that what we're seeing is the majority of crashes are absolutely left or right hook crashes. Hmm. When you have a head-on collision involving a bicyclist, at least in this country, it means that a motorist has crossed over the double yellow line, which is illegal, and has plowed into somebody on a bike head-on. Or, for example, I mean, there's obviously other ways that could occur, but those are not as prevalent. The left and right hook crashes are absolutely without any question. They account for the largest number of crash victims that we represent. What I'd say is that the increase in crashes that are the result of a cyclist being struck directly from behind, that increase is more significant than any other type of crash increase that we've seen probably in the last decade.
And are the number of crashes increasing in the US right now? What kind of increase are we talking about here?
So unfortunately, because so many bike crashes are not reported, because crashes involving bicyclists are significantly underreported, talking about a very specific demographic or type of bike crashes that involve people who, either children or people who would be considered, you know, middle or upper middle class. They're on road bikes, tri bikes, touring bikes, whatever it might be. For our relegated or our dependent cycling community, the statistics are all over the place and they're very unreliable. That being said, when we look at traffic violence in America, the prevalence of all different types of crashes and traffic fatalities are slowly but surely decreasing. The mortality rate, however, for middle-aged men on bikes in the US is increasing. They are the only demographic for which the crash prevalence is increasing versus decreasing. So that's how significant the epidemic is.
And to what extent, if you peruse the forums and you hear stories and you hear about drivers' attitudes towards cyclists, is that something that you can speak to from a more statistical or, let's say, evidence-based point of view? Are attitudes changing, or have they changed over time?
I think my answer is applicable to what's happening in general. And that's that intolerance is unavoidable. People are intolerant of anything and everything. And so that is relevant in cycling as far as people behind the wheel not believing that they should share the road with people on bikes. And that intolerance exists everywhere. Impatience, entitlement, all of those things are factors. The biggest way that a person on a bike could contribute to a positive change in that aspect of bike culture here is to set the example and be the change that they would like to see, as absurd as that might sound. The reality is that it only takes one bicyclist to do something that is either unlawful or reckless in front of a motorist, for that motorist to decide that every person on a bike behaves that way. It also goes both ways.
Exactly.
Once you are struck while riding your bike, you are on heightened alert and you are hypersensitive to the way that people drive around you in ways that you were not before. And that's because you've had that experience. So I think that it's tough because bike advocacy is full of landmines, right? It's really, really difficult to accomplish things because the needs of the cycling community are so diverse. That being said, across the board, what I do on my bike in Florida is going to have some effect in some way on people who are riding their bikes in California. That's just how it works, right? These teeny tiny little ripples come together and create these very large tidal waves. And so if everybody on a bike just made a commitment to ride as predictably and respectfully as possible, even if they don't know the specific bike laws for the places where they're riding, just generally using common sense and understanding that anytime you pit a vehicle, a motor vehicle against a person on a bike, we know who's going to win, right? So if we know that there is certainty of outcome, right? If there is a problem, then what can we be doing to de-escalate those types of problems? I think that there is an exaggeration that all people in cars hate all people on bikes. I think that there is an inflammatory promotion of another exaggeration, which is that all cyclists disobey the laws or don't respect traffic signals or stop signs. The reality is that we're talking about a margin of what, maybe 5 seconds, 5 minutes. When we look at the amount of time that's spent and the amount of suffering that is a consequence of thinking about things in an isolated echo chamber, I think that's where we get into a really unfortunate predicament, which is that we are not making any progress. People are being hurt and they're dying in record numbers. And that is a very difficult thing, I think, to accept and come to terms with, because it's going to require every person on a bike to make a contribution to change the cultural circumstances that have allowed the crash prevalence to increase.
Yeah, that is an excellent message. I couldn't agree more. And let's get into some of the discussion around the legal consequences. If you do have a crash or a family member has a crash, what can you give an overview of the legal process when that happens? What will happen? What should one do?
So, our country, the U.S. is the insurance industry here is very different than it is in other places when it comes to your healthcare as well as your automotive insurance. The levels of insurance, what is required, the minimum amount of coverage a person has to have to lawfully operate a motor vehicle on a public roadway, it varies from place to place. The most important thing is that, and obviously this is if you are able, if it is safe to do so, call 911. call the police. Accept the medical care that is offered by first responders, EMS, ambulance, whatever it might be. Feeling like you're okay in the moments immediately after a crash, those feelings are going to change, regardless of the severity of your injuries. We're talking about this in the context of a triathlon or a multi-sport, context. All of us know that the delayed onset of muscle soreness is a real thing. And when we go out for those really, really tough power rides or intervals, or we're doing speed work on the track, our bodies are going to feel different a day later than they do immediately after. The endorphins, the adrenaline, all of that survival mode, fight or flight stuff that happens when you're in a traumatic situation like that, they cloud your judgment and they don't allow you to really settle into how you're going to feel in the future. So what we try to do at Bike Law is make sure that we are thinking about people on bikes at the moment or before the impact, when the crash occurs, and we're thinking about them 10 years into the future. So you want to document everything. Even if you feel like that soreness, those contusions, the road rash might heal in a couple of weeks or a couple of months. Maybe instead of running, we're going to do aqua jogging or go to yoga or whatever it might be. You can't go back, right? You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So protect yourself by, and it's frustrating here for sure, going to the doctor, making sure that you do call law enforcement, making sure there is a crash report, even if it's inadmissible in court. You want to make sure that you have documentation, because when you go to seek compensation from an at-fault driver's insurance company, the only thing they care about is that documentation. You need to have medical records. You need to have medical bills. You need to have photos. You need to have something that says that the claim that you're opening or the allegations that you're making against that driver are meritorious. And so it is a very dehumanizing set of facts and instructions. But that is the way that it is. And so instead of spending a bunch of time feeling aggrieved by the process, what we try to do is make sure that people understand how they can best posture themselves to be successful through that process. So again, call 911, accept the medical care, go to the hospital, go to the doctor, evaluate yourself from head to toe. What I tell our clients is I want you to make a list. You can do it on a pad of paper. You can store it as a note on your phone. It doesn't matter. Doesn't have to be super detailed. But start at the top of your head and work your way all the way down to your toes. And if something feels different than it did before the crash, write it down. Make sure that somebody understands that this is something you're going through that you were not going through before the collision. It might not require invasive medical treatment, but you want to have a record of what happened.
And in what situations would working with an attorney be recommended? Are there, for smaller crashes, for example, are people able to just deal directly with the motorist's insurance company to file their claims and get their compensation? Or even in these situations, is it generally advised and easier to work with an attorney?
So I think that the general rule of thumb would be call us no matter what. We're going to answer the questions that you have, regardless of whether or not we think that you need to hire a lawyer, or regardless of whether or not you retain us to represent you or somebody else. Our dog in the fight is arming people with information, making sure that they are confident in their own knowledge of what the possible outcomes are, what their choices are, what their rights are, and certainly what their responsibilities are as well. So we don't operate like a typical law firm. And what I mean by that is not that there aren't other firms or lawyers that couldn't do a fantastic job, because there are. It's that there are elements to the process when you retain a lawyer in the Bike Law Network that are going to make you feel differently, more confident, and certainly more cared for and validated than you would going elsewhere. Bike crashes don't happen Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. They just don't. The majority of our clients are not being struck during the workday. It's before work, after work, and on the weekends. So having somebody or a team of legal professionals that are available to you to talk about the things that are important to you as a cyclist. A car crash or a car accident is very different than a bike crash. Nobody is commuting to work in rush hour traffic thinking about how empowering sitting there in their vehicle is in stop and go traffic. Nobody enjoys that. However, every single person who is choosing to ride the bike for recreational or for fitness purposes is doing so of their own volition because they want to. And if we think back to our earliest experiences as children on bikes, it was a feeling of freedom, of flying, of joy. And so the delta between feeling those things and being either incapacitated or a hostage to your own body because of injuries suffered in a crash, they're two totally different animals, right? Right. Car accidents are just, they're nothing like bike crashes. So call us. We're going to treat you. Number one, we understand we've been where you've been. Number two, we only represent people on bikes. We don't practice other types of law. And number three, we're going to answer the questions you have. And those questions might not be legal. They might be related to something else, but we're going to offer those services to you regardless of what your financial situation is, regardless of how much insurance money there is. We respond to every inquiry that we receive from somebody in our community if it's related to the bike.
And can you give an overview of how you represent your clients? So what I mean is, are the majority of cases dealing directly with an insurance company, or are there a lot of court cases? What does it look like when you work with clients, or give the most common examples that that you work in?
So because, like we had already discussed, the US is very different from other countries around the world, in which the individual states have their ability to enact and enforce their own set of rules and laws. Certain jurisdictions in this country are what are called contributory negligence jurisdictions. So in the United States, if you ride a bike in Virginia, Alabama, North Carolina, or Maryland, the law there says if you are determined to have contributed 1% to your crash, then you are barred 100% from any civil recovery. Well, what's 1%? If the law says as far right as practicable, but the law enforcement officer determines that that wasn't where you were riding, if the law says that you have to have a rear red blinky light and you don't realize that the battery in your light died, if the law says that you may not ride two abreast, but you were, even if the motorist was as reckless as could be, an insurance company is going to say, well, this is our way to deny liability. This is the way that we're going to get out of having to pay that victim any money. So for the bike law lawyers in those jurisdictions, they are in the courtroom much more frequently than in other places, because in order to pursue any sort of recovery, financial recovery for their clients, they're going to have to file a lawsuit and try the case. Ann Groniger, who she's Bike Law North Carolina, a contrib jurisdiction, as well as Bike Law Utah, she spends the majority of her time actively litigating. She's a trial lawyer because she doesn't have a choice. The act of riding a bike, by definition, is imperfect. It is not like operating a motor vehicle. So when you have, number one, the people who, if you think about the crash response as a pipeline, the first valve, that first group of people to be involved are the police. Well, they're not witnesses to the crash. So they're getting the statement from a driver who does not want to get a ticket or be arrested or charged with some violation of a traffic law. And they might not be able to get the statement from the bicyclist, because again, when you pit a 5,000-pound box of steel with a motor against a human being on a bike, we know who's going to win. So that crash report might not accurately tell the story or address or allocate the blame to the appropriate party. In other places, it's an even mix, right? There are There are times where there is a need to try a case for a variety of reasons, and there are plenty of cases in which the facts are so indisputable that the insurance company for the driver cannot contest or deny liability, and then the process is different. We, at our firm, Peter and I, we have clients who there is no money. There's no insurance money. The driver is criminally indigent or had no insurance or fled the scene and we can't identify who the person behind the wheel was. We take those cases pro bono. We try them. We treat them the same way that we would a client where there's $1 million of insurance money. We don't care. We treat all of these cases the same way. And unfortunately, because the insurance requirements are different from place to place, there is absolutely no way of knowing who's going to be involved or which entity, if there is one, is going to be making the decision about valuation of damages.
What are the biggest challenges that commonly come up in different types of cases? Some of the most common challenges that you run into?
Brain injuries, for sure. I think that there's a misconception amongst many, many people, both cyclists and non-bike people, that wearing a helmet is going to save your life. I'm not saying that it's not going to save your life. And so there's also a jump to, well, is she saying don't wear a helmet? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. Obviously, buckle your seatbelt when you're in the car. Wear a helmet if you're on a bike. But helmets aren't meant to protect your brain. They're meant to protect your skull. Right? So they're meant to prevent your head from suffering an injury in which your brain spills out onto the pavement. We could look at football players in the US, right? The prevalence of, you know, concussive syndrome and CTE amongst NFL players who have the best helmets made anywhere in the world is incredibly high because when you think about your head, your brain is a soft piece of fruit sitting inside of a mason jar filled with fluid. When there is a crash and your head strikes the ground inside of a helmet, what happens is your brain, that soft piece of fruit, if you imagine it visually, gets slammed up against one portion of your skull. Then Newton says that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Then your brain is slammed against the equal and opposite part of your skull. So if you hit your head on the front left side, your back right side of your brain is going to absorb the second, you know, largest amount of impact. How do you diagnose or how do you document the consequences or symptoms of a brain injury when they may present 3 weeks later, a month later, 4 months later, a year later, and they may wax and wane? So short-term memory, word searching, forgetting numbers, emotional irritability, the inability to organize your thoughts. How do you create value for those things when they might only be noticeable to the victim, to the cyclist, or to the people that have known them and have been close with them in an intimate way for years and years prior to the crash? So when we talk about what is the hardest part for us, what is the single great? I mean, if everything else falls into line, trying to understand how you convince an insurance company, a multi-billion dollar for-profit industry whose objective is to protect its bottom line for its shareholders, how do you explain to that entity that a person who is otherwise fit, healthy, can ride a bike, go to work, perform their daily activities and duties, but who feels trapped inside of their head in a way that is very difficult to document, to understand? That is a very big challenge for us. There is no pre-crash baseline metric. Nobody goes out to get a neuropsych eval before they're in need of one, right? So you have nothing to compare it to. Most people on bikes fall into a larger category of folks who are hardworking, organized, highly functioning, pretty driven, independent. It's very, very hard to take people who have those characteristics and personality traits and explain how these marginal differences to an insurance company are worth what they're actually worth. Because those marginal differences to that cyclist, they create problems that are across every facet of their lives. So that is probably the single greatest challenge in working a lot of these cases.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That does sound like an incredible challenge. For people in the US, do you have people in all the different states that are working, or are there certain? Yeah, where do you operate exactly? In what states are you in operation?
So the best way to answer that question is probably to either go to our website or reach out to us directly. There's an expectation, I think, that as a national resource, that we're looking to fill up the entire map, to have 51 lawyers in each, you know, one in every jurisdiction that does what the next one does. The way that we approach the Bike Law Network is the same way that we would encourage people to approach their selection of the lawyer or the attorney that they hire to represent them in a matter. Peter and I, there's just one question. When we're looking at and responding to all of these lawyers who want to join our organization, there's only one question. Would I hire them to represent me? And if the answer is no, then the answer is no. We will never recommend or refer a member of our community to somebody that we would not hire ourselves to represent us. And that's with all the knowledge and experience that we have in representing cyclists. So, if people want to go to our website, which is bikelaw.com, there is a map and there are profiles and landing pages for all of our network attorneys. We also have affiliated relationships with lawyers who might not be part of the Bike Law Network, but who we work with as either local or of counsel to other lawyers' firms that are in the Bike Law Network, because we would hire them ourselves. They might not have a bike-only practice, but their competence and compassion certainly meet the standards that we have, which are very, very high for the people that are coming to us after they've suffered the indignities of a crash.
And the final question I want to ask, you already answered a big part of it, I think, when we talked about what cyclists can do to create a safer environment. But in addition to that, are there other things related to legislation, or just anybody can contribute to how society works, or other factors that you think could contribute to safer roads for everybody, including cyclists?
Yeah, I think that the overarching answer is get involved, right? We see it in other aspects of social culture. You know, for example, if you don't like something, vote. Right? Participate in the pursuit of whatever that change might be. It's the same thing in cycling. We have a huge database of boots on the ground, grassroots organizations who are devoted wholly to affecting positive change in bike advocacy. Volunteer, ask questions, find out how you can. It might be as simple as asking your neighbor to go on a bike ride with you, getting somebody else in the saddle, maybe sacrificing that interval ride that you might have scheduled for a casual cruise around the neighborhood or on the trail with somebody who doesn't ride comfortably, going with a person their first time to a bike shop so they don't feel intimidated, just those types of things. For people who are on bikes that have children, when you go on road trips, have them count the cyclists that they pass. When they become drivers themselves, they'll be cognizant of the bikers that they are passing on the roadway. Get them on bikes themselves. A lot of the most effective ways that people can influence or affect change is through education. So if there is knowledge that you can impart upon someone else, if you can take an active role, and it doesn't have to be, I'm willing to give 20 hours a week, right? It's very, very simple. It could just start at home. It could start with your spouse, your partner, your children, your friends, your coworkers. Introducing them to and creating space for them to develop a relationship with the bike is probably the most important thing. Because again, the more of us there are, the safer we're going to be.
Yeah, I thought that was a very hard question. So I must say I'm very impressed by that answer, because I expected it to be a difficult one with not so many specific examples, but you gave a lot of great examples. So thank you for that. You mentioned bikelaw.com already, so that's where people can find you. Are there any other recommended resources that people should have a look at if they're interested in learning more, whether it be specific resources on your website or off the website?
Sure. So we are, our activity on social media kind of waxes and wanes, and that is largely in part because that is not our primary focus. We are not in the professional industry of influencing people on social media. We try to be as active as possible, but you can follow us on Instagram at Bike Law or on Facebook. You can reach out to us anytime. And if we don't know the answer, we will tell you. But I think generally people's questions are as broad and as diverse as the members of our community are. And so I think that the best answer is to ask those specific questions. We're incredibly responsive. There is no stupid question. We encourage people to be as inquisitive as possible. And I think that generally, thinking about how you behave when you're on the bike or behind the wheel, or neither, just in your day-to-day life, how can the things that you do or don't do impact the rest of our community? How can we participate in a way that embraces the ethos that we're all in it together? I think that that's the most important thing. I think that that is the fundamental belief that propels Bike Law from where it started and how it started into what we've become and where we envision ourselves in the future. And as a resource, you can get in touch with us at any time. We are more than happy to talk about any topic. And the answers to all the questions are going to be very specific to the person posing the question and where they live. So it's really hard to make a more general or provide a more general answer, but you can get in touch with us. We're reachable, we're findable all the time. And again, we're happy to talk to anybody about any topic that's related to cycling.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Rachel. It's been super, super useful and informative. I really enjoyed it. And hope to talk to you again another time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. I have to say that for me, I think Rachel is one of the most well-spoken and articulate people I've ever spoken to. So it was super fun to do that interview and very easy to conduct it, even though it wasn't a topic that I know very little about. So that was a plus. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. And if you want to learn more about Bike Law, of course, check out their website, which I have linked to in the show notes and in the episode description in your podcast app. There is one thing from the interview that I want to highlight as something that stood out to me personally, and that is the part about bike advocacy. This stood out because this is something that we can all do and benefit from, even though hopefully most of us will not be involved in a crash, so most of us won't need the advice on the legal processes that we talked about. Rachel brought up several things that we can do in terms of bike advocacy. The two that I wrote down, maybe there were more, but I wrote down to ride correctly and to get involved in my notebook. And if we start with ride correctly, I think this is so important because I know just how much one bad driver can ruin an entire ride for me. And the same thing, I'm not meaning a driver that crashes into me, because fortunately that hasn't really happened. I've had some small fender benders, but nothing terrible. A driver that drives too close or that is aggressive or shouts verbal abuse, those sorts of things, that can ruin an entire long ride that was wonderful. Then this happens in the last 15 minutes and it ruins the ride. And it colors my view of and perception of all drivers, not just this one particular driver. Unfortunately, I think that that's human nature. That's what happens. And the same thing happens in reverse to drivers when cyclists, let's say, don't stop at stop signs or run red lights, etc. So we should be mindful of that. And we can all do our piece to change the perception that some drivers may have of cyclists by riding correctly in all situations. And that's very, very important. And I think that that's something that we can all take with us. The second part about bike advocacy and on the more positive note, I think is that the one about getting involved. So things like going on a ride with somebody that never goes cycling, volunteering, getting involved with local organizations for cyclists, all those sorts of things. I think this is brilliant advice, because the more we grow the pool of people that have some connection to cycling, the more we can increase the understanding of cycling and cyclists among drivers. And that can only be a positive for road safety, for attitudes, and of course, for many other reasons as well, not least of which is public health. So let's all commit to always riding correctly and to try to get involved in some way, no matter how small, to make a positive contribution to road safety and to cycling. And now coming back to the topic of training a little bit here at the end of the podcast, which is what we normally talk about on most episodes. If you need any help with your triathlon training or endurance training, check out our coaching, training plans and consultation options on scientifictriathlon.com. One of the best reviews of our coaching services that I was reflecting on the other day is the number of athletes that have been working continuously with us for 5 to 6 years, which was the point when our coaching team and athlete roster started growing. And we have a very decent number of athletes that have been with the coach that they're with ever since they started working with scientifictriathlon.com. Since that coach started working with scientifictriathlon.com, I should say, which started happening 6 years ago, we brought on the first coach other than myself. And I think this is testament to the quality of coaching across the board of all of our coaches and how much value our athletes are getting from it. And I hope that this continues. And in 4 years, I can say that we have athletes that have been working with us continuously for 10 years. If you're coaching us out of your budget and you need budget-friendly options rather than coaching and other personalized services, then you can still consider using some scientific triathlon products. So we have ready-made training plans. And just the last 2 days, I received 2 great emails giving me feedback on their success with these training plans. The first one writes, "Good morning, Michael. Thank you very much for your intermediate 7.3 plan on Training Peaks. I stuck with the plan for the most part, following the 90% goal, and completed my half distance try yesterday. It was a great time, and I shaved 27 minutes off of my time from last year, from 5:37 to 5:10. The plan worked very well, and I look forward to more content from you as well as more improvements as I continue the journey." And the other email was, "Hi, Michael, I want to thank you for a great podcast and great training plans. I have used your intermediate full Ironman plan for 2 years and have improved almost 1 hour from the first full Ironman that I did in 2021 to the one that I completed in Hamburg this year with a new PB of 10:27. Many thanks." So as you can see, it's still very possible to make great improvements even on ready-made training plan, even on the ready-made training plan without all of the personalization of coaching. It doesn't have to be so black and white that it's either full coaching or nothing at all. There are intermediate options, and they can all be helpful. So check out scientifictriathlon.com for more information about everything we have to offer there. And finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.